Welcome to the Big Mike Fund Podcast, where you learn about advanced wealth building strategies from real estate investing to creating massive ROI and secured retirement profits. So pour yourself a cup of coffee, grab a notepad, and lean in, because Big Mike has got the mic, starting now.
Welcome to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. I'm the Big Mike. And it's my distinct privilege and honor to have Wendy Sweep and Bill Furman on the podcast. Hi, Wendy. Hi, Bill.
How you doing?
Hey, Mikey. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate you having you here. How's the weather in Carolinas?
It got up to 66 degrees yesterday. I thought it was midsummer.
And the day before, it didn't get out of 30. So it's wonderful.
Wonderful. Up quite a bit.
Yes.
Were you hit at all by this Northeaster?
We were. It was hard. We even got into single digits, which is crazy for us. For 3 weeks, we were freezing. But
yeah, same thing in New York. The whole East Coast got to enjoy a nice cold breeze.
It's an understatement.
Yeah. You didn't have 66 yesterday, did you?
No, we are hovering today around 32 degrees, and yesterday was freezing, and on Saturday it was like 8 degrees. It was like 10 or 8 degrees. It was really, really cold.
See, that's why we live in the South.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about your business. You guys are co-managers of the Carolina Hard Money Fund. I've known you for many years. We've been friends for a long, long time. Yes. You're very successful hard money fund managers. Talk to me a little bit about what is your fund all about. And I know you're focused on Carolinas, but I'd like to hear from you. How's real estate over there and what you've been doing lately?
We are blessed to be in the Carolinas. We have one of the best real estate markets in the country right now. The regentrification of downtown Charlotte, Raleigh, Durham, Asheville, Charleston, South Carolina, Greenville, South Carolina. We have a lot of things going on here, and we're so thrilled that we're here in the middle of all of it. So we really started out just doing rehab loans, but now much of what we do is construction rehab or construction ground up build, which really is a great niche for us because it falls into a part of the lending community out there. They can't get loans. The borrowing community is having a difficult time getting loans from banks in that ground up construction niche. And we've been able to kind of slip right into that. We also have a huge millennial contingency to deal with here. We've got probably the highest millennial population in the country per capita. And, their income is higher. So we've just had a crazy growth explosion, and you always look for the end to come up, and we're seeing it continuing in the pretty distant future. We're pretty excited about it.
Well, one of the things is that Wendy and I have been in the Charlotte market since 1970, and when we got here, you had a city that it's nothing like New York, obviously, but at 5 o'clock, it was like 5:15, the last person to shut the lights off in the downtown area. And then everybody went out to the suburbs to go home. Well, with that large millennial population, they all want to be closer to downtown and things to do. And Charlotte's done a really good job of bringing activities after 5 o'clock into the downtown area. Millennials also like homes that have character. Of course, they don't want homes with character that have problems either. They want them finished. And it's been a really good opportunity for the custom builder to go into these individual neighborhoods and start redoing these homes closer to public transportation and restaurants and employment. And, it doesn't fit the track builder model. So it is perfect for private lending to step in and take care of that niche.
And price points are pretty high too. Yeah. I mean, our for us anyway, the after repaired values are running from 400 to 850 is really the sweet spot in those areas. We have several that are going over $1 million and just a few that are under 400, but the majority of them are in a pretty good sweet spot.
Yeah, that's very enlightening that downtowns are reviving. The inner cities, well, I don't know if they're called inner cities anymore, but what used to be bad neighborhoods are now go through gentrification. It's true in many, many markets. And folks want to live near the center of activity, and right. especially millennials. Some kind of nightlife, and you can't, I mean, you guess you could have nightlife in suburbs, but it's usually that stuff happens around downtown area where there are more restaurants, more bars, more things to do. Mm-hmm. So that's very interesting opportunity. Sort of, I guess these are infill projects.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And see, the other thing, too, is unlike cities, and I'll give you an example, Seattle, where it's very difficult to build in Seattle based on the municipality's rules. They're kind of holding development down. Charlotte, especially, and most of the other cities.
Yeah.
Yeah. They love the development because obviously they can get more people crammed into a smaller space. They don't have to provide as much of the utilities and services, and the services that, it would take up space in the suburbs. So they're happy to take a lot that normally would have a single family home on it and make it developable for, two, four, six units. Mm-hmm. And so it's really helping the developer make a lot more money. And everybody's on board.
And that makes sense. So are they developing mostly, instead of single family housing, they're developing two to four unit small multifamily? Is that what's happening? Most of the constructions that you're financing, are they?
Well, that's another.
Or townhomes.
Yeah, that's another thing that's happening. So many of these properties that are in the inner city anyway, that they're knocking down, were duplexes and quad to begin with. So in the beginning, they were putting up single family homes to replace this, but the builders are getting smarter and they are rebuilding with townhomes that they could sell individually, and where they would normally sell the house if it were single family for $650, they're now selling these townhomes at $300,000 to $400,000 a piece on the same piece of property.
But they've been a couple.
Their returns are so much greater at this point, and they're really tapping into that market. The only area that we're really having trouble getting things approved for building would be Charleston. But that's a whole anomaly.
It's all
anomaly.
A historical district kind of thing there. They would prefer to have the old home fall over than build a new one.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy, crazy difficult, but people are still doing it. It just takes literally a year to 2 years to build in that area.
Yeah, I mean, I see a little bit of this in New York City, too, when they have historic homes. So you'll see a very old property, and it has to be maintained, especially outside the way it looked 150 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, the whole trend makes a lot of sense. Infills are happening. I have to say downtown Brooklyn has gone through major, major rejuvenation. I was just there over the weekend. They built a beautiful Apple store next to the Barclays Center. Barclays Center is the new basketball.
Nets play there, right?
Yeah, exactly. The whole area has just been so regentrified and improved. It's just unbelievable. It used to be a really rough area, and now it's a much better area. But
awesome.
they still, unfortunately, sell weed on the streets. So.
That's okay. One of our builders finished up a house in one of those, regentrified areas and put in all new landscaping and bushes. The last thing he did, and then they went to put the for sale sign out, and all the bushes had been stolen.
Yeah, it's interesting what happens. Yeah, I mean, I live in a very liberal state. New York is very liberal. As you guys know, in California, they just legalized weed.
Right.
Weed. New York is moving in that direction. It's kind of a interesting trend.
Yes, it is.
Anyway, so let's talk a little bit about your fund specifically. So you're funding new construction, which is a great niche. I think you have a phenomenal success story. And as number of old rehabs dwindled down and new construction dwindled up, you've taken advantage of that. And I know you're able to do some great projects. Can you talk a little bit about kind of your, just your fund in general? It's a mortgage pool fund. You raise capital from investors. Can you talk a little bit about your fund structure, how much money you've raised, how many years you've been doing it? And I've known you for many years, and you've been at this for quite a while. So just share with the audience a little bit your success story.
Well, sure. Listen, when we first started doing this, we were utilizing individuals that had IRAs or just cash in the bank, and we were essentially brokering loans to these individuals. And as you probably started out doing something similar, it gets a little unwieldy when you have 85 individual investors and you're trying to put these deals together. Anyway, we decided to start this fund. It started in October of 2014. It was slow going for us raising capital in the beginning because everyone that we knew that had money that wanted to invest were active investors. And when you invest in a fund, you become a passive investor. And it's very difficult for people to kind of give up that hand in each deal. And you can't do that in a fund. So it was difficult. It took us a couple of years to, you know, raise our first million and a half. We're at 13.7 now.
That's great. That's
and most of that has come within the last, actually the majority of that has come within the last year and a half. Mm-hmm. So our returns, and you know how this works in a loan fund, all your income is trailing. When you're use the accrual accounting method for your points, let's say, for example, our loan is 9 months in duration. Any origination points that fund receives is not realized over a 9 month period. You can't take it when you get it. It's not cashed when you get it. You have to realize it over a 9 month period.
Then your
payments, when they come in, they're typically a month and a half to 2 months from when you make the loan. Right. So when you take large amounts of capital each quarter and add them to your operating account, we're putting the money to work right away, but we're not receiving it right away. So it lowers the yields for everyone. We do our best by having a subscription account where the money, you know, sits until it's able to be used. So it doesn't lower the yields for the investors, but we were still able to maintain double digit returns during that period. So I'm real happy about that. The structure of our fund is pretty simple. We're only doing equity. We do not do any notes. So it's a totally an equity fund.
Just to clarify, you receive investments in the fund in the equity units. And then you place the money as hard money loans, just to clarify for the audience. You don't borrow the money into the fund. You only sell equity units. That's the big difference. People may get a little bit confused. Your product is hard money loans, but right. The way you raise capital is by selling equity units.
Correct. And we start off with $1,000 a share when you're purchasing it. Our strategy is at the end of each quarter, the shares are going to be worth $1,000. So right. we're scraping all the expenses, and then the rest of the money is paid out to the investors. They can either get money directly deposited to them if they want cash flow, or they can use that money to roll over and buy new shares each quarter. So we don't get share appreciation, but they get more shares at the end of every quarter. So it's great for long-term investors, because when you can take your money and compound it over time, you're earning a lot more than the actual coupon yearly returns. So
yeah, the power of compounding. Exactly.
Yeah, it's awesome. So, you know, in short, we have a 24-month lockup period, meaning you have to stay in for at least 24 months or you have to pay a penalty to get out early. Once then, you keep it in there as long as you want. You can change your election of compounding it or cash flow at any time. Everything takes, we do everything on the quarter. So if you want to make any changes, it's, each quarter. We do have a preferred rate of 8%, which is really more of a benchmark than anything else. But the investors get 100% up to 8%, and then there's a split with the management company and the fund. Anything above 8%, the fund getting 60% of that, and we get 40% of it. So, it's worked out great for everyone.
I think it's a good model. You have 8% pref and a 60-40 split above the pref. And the pref, I like to call it the floor, but it's not guaranteed floor. So right. We have similar models in our funds. And for the audience, when you hear preferred return or pref, it's not a guaranteed return. And if somebody guarantees you, probably his name is Bernie Madoff.
Well, but, I mean, there are guarantees. If you have a fund where you have notes as part of the fund, you can get a guaranteed note rate if you're lending a fund money.
That's right.
But if you're an equity investor, there's never a guarantee.
There's still no guarantee even when folks invest in a note. It's basically
that's true.
The strength of the company. Essentially,
yes.
They're a lender on a capital stack. They're senior to the equity units. So from that perspective, they have higher level of safety, but it's not guaranteed. The way I think of the guarantee, typically in the classic sense, it's guaranteed by the U.S. government or maybe some backed by some insurance product. I'm not aware of any insurance product that can guarantee these type of notes. So these are high yield notes if you were to take capital as promissory notes. But let's go back to what you have. You have equity units, and with equity units, there is no guarantee. It's the preferential return. People get paid if the returns are there. If not, the manager doesn't get any performance split. But just clarification, it's a sort of psychological floor, but it's not necessarily a guaranteed floor. So
sure.
I just wanted to clarify this for the audience.
And there's one little extra in there, too. If we don't hit our preferred rate of 8% in any one quarter, we also have a clawback where we won't get a split for the next following two quarters either. So it's imperative that we make good decisions.
you catch up. Yeah, yeah, you have a cumulative pref, I assume.
Yeah.
For the audience, for those of you who invest in funds, it's a really important question. When you hear any kind of a deal or you invest in a fund, you should ask the question if the pref is cumulative or not. And I'm sure the same thing for you, Bill and Wendy, you guys have cumulative but not compounded pref. And that's the way to go. Essentially, right. If you underpay a little bit, you have a responsibility to catch up, and we do the same in our flagship fund, and we're both on all of our funds, Tampa Opportunity Fund and TF Investment Fund too. All right, let's talk a little bit about, I wanted to switch the subject and chat very briefly about something that, Wendy, you have had great, well, you have had some interesting experience, and I remember at the last or a couple of Collective Genius masterminds ago, you talked a little bit about short-term rentals, seasonal or short-term rentals, and I think Airbnb, and you have a project like that. How has your experience been in that? Do you like it? I heard it's the latest kind of a trend. Is that worth the time? Have you had a good amount of success with that? And where's your property located?
Well, I have two properties, actually, and I love this. And I do come from a hotel background when I was in my early 20s. So I have a little bit of experience with overnight guests and that kind of thing. But the Airbnb, and that's what I call it, is the Airbnb. It is short-term rentals. It's been great. I've got one property that was it's a four-bedroom, two-bath house in Rock Hill, not even in a neighborhood. It's off of a busy street. It's 1,000 square foot house with an 1,000 square foot basement that's been finished. And I get anywhere from $79 to $179 a night. And I'm running a 92% occupancy in that house. And it's nowhere. So it's amazing. It cost me maybe $5,000 to get it set up. That's with the furniture and the knickknacks and the towels and the toilet paper and everything that you have to put in it. I mean, there is a lot of work in getting it set up, but there are companies out there that will do all of that for you. They charge anywhere from 20 to 30% of the income that you get off of it.
But do they run the property for you? Are they?
But they, yeah, I actually have somebody that works for me that runs my properties.
Okay.
But I did the first one with her, so I could really get to know what needed to be done. And you do kind of have to, there's work. I mean, there's work involved. It's not, you know, a set it and forget it unless you have somebody doing that for you. But it's the money that I get off of that house is triple what I would get if I were just renting it.
Got it.
So for me, that's worth it. Now, there's a lot of people that are getting into these short-term vacation rentals, and they're thinking, oh, well, I can pay more for this house because I've got a short-term vacation rental in it and I'm going to get higher income. I understand why they think that way, but I think it's foolish for them to do that because there's always the chance that your municipality may come in and say, you know what, you can't have short-term rentals there, or your HOA may cut you off, or whatever it might be that will keep you from doing that. Now you're stuck in a house that you're only going to get regular rent off of. So there's so many investors out there that have self-directed IRAs, things like that, that are interested in getting an 8, 10, 12% return on their money that can finance not only the purchase of these houses for you, but can finance the upfit as well. And you know, you put them on a short term to pay them off, and it's easy to pay them off, especially in the beginning when you're getting such a huge return on your rental. There's so many places that you can do this. You can do it in a business district. You can do it on the beach. You can do it in any kind of resort, but you can do it in the middle of nowhere and it works. You can rent. I've got a good friend that's doing an Airstream in her backyard, and she gets $125 a night for that, and it stays booked. It's just, it's amazing. People that are gravitating toward the short-term rental. You know, you think about if you're traveling with a family of 5, 6, 7 people, you can't just get one room. You have to get 2 or 3. And do you have a kitchen? So when you're setting up your rates, you really set them up for just under what they would pay for a hotel room to begin with. Plus you have the amenities of having the den, the kitchen, you know, more than one bathroom to use. You're all in the same place. It makes a big difference. So it's wonderful. And then Bill and I had one in our office here. We're in a house. Our office is built in 1901, and we didn't need all of the office space. So we took 2 rooms, had a den, a full bath, and a bedroom with a separate entrance that we ran as Airbnb. We probably ran a 70, 73, 74% occupancy on that. Unfortunately, we literally shut that down yesterday because we're growing and we need the office space. So we're looking for others, and really it's kind of a passion for me right now. I am, my goal is to have 10 by the end of the year.
Wow. That's a success story. That's wonderful to hear. So one quick question. So when you're doing this Airbnb, are you renting rooms or you're renting the whole house to one family?
Now you can choose either. All of that is available and both do well, but I want to rent the entire house. It's more work just to do rooms.
Right.
But I do have a friend who rents a condo in downtown Charlotte. She's right on the light rail. She has a 2-bedroom apartment that she rents. It's a condo, and she rents all the space except the master bedroom. That's where she lives. Her office is in there, and she loves it. She's been doing it for 2 years, and she's making money off of living downtown.
Yeah, that's an interesting concept. I have to say that for folks who consider doing this, they should definitely check with municipal laws.
In New York City, yes.
There's a massive hotel lobby, and they're fighting Airbnb. And
you need to pay hotel tax, too.
Yeah, you have to pay hotel tax, and the other thing that happens is some, like, New York City does not allow room rental, and people do it, but they do it illegally. And,
right.
It's inappropriate, obviously. But
and Airbnb has a great software system set up. They actually collect taxes and pay the occupancy tax for me. They also pay the person that I've hired to help me. She gets 20% of everything that I do and the cleaning fee, which is an additional charge that the person staying there pays as well. That all goes directly to her. They do her 1099s. I don't have to worry about any of that. It's pretty cool.
So it all goes through Airbnb software. So
that's correct. That's Airbnb. Correct.
That's great. Yeah, it saves you a lot of nightmare with accounting. And
that's right. And I'm only using Airbnb, but there are, you know, you've got HomeAway and VRBO, and there's some other sites too that you can use to do the short-term vacation rentals. In fact, I love it so much that I also have a real estate company. I've had my license for over 30 years in both North and South Carolina. And I am also going to be a management company for Airbnbs as well, short-term vacation rentals.
That's great. I mean, there's the opportunity. Before this call, we were chatting about enhancing your fund or launching a new fund. If you invest in Airbnb.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
You have a lot of expertise. You have a passion for it. And you have success. And the numbers are great. They work out to be phenomenal cash flow. It's a little bit more active than traditional real estate, rent it and forget it.
But that's right. That's fund number two.
But the key is to have a good team running these things for you, because, you know, who has the time? But, you know, having somebody that's really worthy, that's responsible for taking care of that, makes all the difference in the world.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's an operating business. So if you have a good team, that's the key. No team,
exactly.
You're going to struggle.
That's right.
That's a phenomenal success story. And maybe we'll have a follow-up call. We can chat a little bit more about your success with this. And this fun two idea, think a little bit about it.
Yeah.
I know you guys both for a long time. I think it's a phenomenal enhancement to your current business. It's a complementary opportunity. Awesome. So a couple of other very, very basic questions. So number one question is, you haven't seen that much yield compression. So my question was, have you seen any yield compression, and what's been going on? I'm guessing is you haven't seen much because you've shifted your business from rehabs to new constructions, and developers make enough profit that are less sensitive to the rate. What's your experience with the rest? Hard money yields compressing.
We're fortunate because we're really the only local hard money lender in the area. All the other competition is from national companies that are in here. And frankly, when you're dealing with construction, we've had borrowers go to some of the other places that are charging less. They end up coming back to us anyway, because while it may cost a little bit less, it is a heck of a lot more convenient to deal with us because we're here. We have feet on the ground. We respond very quickly. It's just easier for them to have a local lender that can meet their needs versus dealing with a national lender. And even though those rates and fees may be a little bit lower, we're still lending them more money than they're going to get from these other companies. Now, it doesn't mean we don't do special deals for repeat borrowers to give them a better outcome, but we're also, I want to say, playing with the companies that are providing the lower rates. We might sell a loan to them and participate in it. And if we're participating in it, our small piece is getting a much higher yield than we normally would have gotten if we were doing the whole loan. So that's kind of offsetting the lower rates that we're giving. So our yields are actually getting higher working in partnership with some of these bigger companies, mm-hmm. if that makes any sense.
That makes perfect sense.
So, you know,
you're selling notes. Are you selling notes completely, or are you keeping a little piece, like a 5% piece?
Well, we'll have a junior 10%. 5, 10, 15, 20, depends on what the deal is. And in that case, we're getting a couple of origination points
on the whole
the entire loan amount.
Right.
So if that makes our yield, you know, in the 20s versus would have been much lower than that if we were doing the first ourselves. So it still works out to our advantage. So even with the compression that we see, we can still participate, and our investors are still making out even better.
The other thing too, if any deal should go south, our boots are right here on the ground, and it's not a situation where we would have to take the house back and sell it. We're in a position to be able to finish the job and be able to put it on the market. I have a real estate company. We can sell it and not only get all of our investment back plus interest and fees, but we get the profit and are able to split the profit with the lender as well. So
that's on an individual. If we were doing an individual, if it was a profit on it in the fund, all of it goes into the fund.
Right. But it's that really helps. The other thing too is if we sell a note and we're holding on to that 10%, the deal should go south. Again, we're boots on the ground. That lender that has the 90% loves that fact because we're here taking care of an issue that they don't want to have to deal with.
Oh, yeah.
So it really, really, it helps us on both ends with it, build a relationship with everybody involved.
I'll give you another quick example. We were in a junior position. We had a deal that went south. We ended up buying the first mortgage back from
the lender,
the senior position lender. Mm-hmm. And then we ended up selling the house and making a profit on that. And so the yield for that deal was through the roof.
Yeah. And that doesn't suck.
Well, it makes a lot of sense. The secondary markets have popped up. We actually also work with a company. I think you know them pretty well too, Pew Street.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, they're great.
And you could basically sell the note and get your liquidity back, and that generates good yield on your money. And, mm-hmm. So all these are brilliant ideas. I appreciate you sharing. I think some of these ideas are very valuable for lenders or note holders where they can get liquidity by selling the note or selling 90% of a node or 80% of the node, or getting their liquidity and maintaining really high yield on a little piece that they keep.
Right.
Yeah. So that makes great sense. We're almost out of time. So I wanted to ask a really important question. Can you recommend a book? Is there a book that you're currently reading that you like? I know you're going to say the Holy Bible, but beyond
that's right.
That's number one recommendation, but beyond that's given. Is there another book that you like to you're reading now, or you want to recommend to folks?
Well, I can tell you that we're getting ready to have our yearly company meeting. We've shut down for 2 days, and plan the upcoming year through the EOS system, the Traction, and all of that, which are all great books. By Gino Wickman. But one of the things that we're reading as a company before we have that meeting is called The Five Dysfunctions of a Team.
Five Dysfunctions of a Team.
Yes.
Okay.
I cannot remember who the author is, But it's The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. And it's really, really good about how you relate differently, how people relate differently to each other. So it kind of changes the way that you can relate to another.
I got another one for you. The author is Mark Jackson. It's Read Me or Stay Broke.
Is it the same Mark Jackson that we know?
Yes.
It's MJ's son.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. MJ's son.
And it's a good book. It really is.
It's a great book. I bought, I think it was 25 or 50 copies when it came out, and I'm handing it out to my real estate subgroup members when they come in, and I'm getting great feedback from it as well from them.
Yeah, thank you for sharing. These are great, great recommendations. I'll share one too. I just got this book and I'm reading it. It's called Liberty Defined. Ron Paul. Actually, I'm heading out to the Hartman's event, Meet the Masters, and Ron is going to be a speaker there. So
awesome.
Kind of an interesting.
Cool.
So I think we're out of time. I very much appreciate you coming on the podcast. It's been an awesome episode. You guys are just phenomenal. Love you both.
And thank you, Mike. We love you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would like to add a little side note. The Airbnb in our office that we shut down, we did it in a timely manner because on Sunday, somebody drove a car into our office right there where the Airbnb was.
Oh, my God.
Everything's cool. Everything's good.
So now we're going to get a new foundation. Hurt. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
No one was staying there at the time.
There's no, I guess, no limit to stupidity or brilliance. So.
That's right.
Anyway, thanks so much for having us on.
Yeah, we appreciate it.
Thank you kindly. Really appreciate you guys.
Thank you for listening to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. To receive your copy of Mike's How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Fund book, head to BigMikeFund.com or visit Amazon and type Mike Zlotnick. Keep listening and keep investing Big Mike style. See you on the next episode.